Welcome to On Air with the Mountain Lion Foundation, broadcasting research and policy discussions to understand the issues that face the American lion. Hello, I'm Julie West. With me today is Deborah Jansen. Deborah is a wildlife biologist for the National Park Service at Big Cypress National Preserve and has been working there for 23 years. She's also been a wildlife technician on the Florida Panther Project in the Everglades National Park and a wildlife management area biologist for Big Cypress National Preserve. Thanks for joining me, Deborah.
Thank you.
Now, each state has its own set of circumstances that affect the survival and stability of the mountain lion population, and I've been interested to read the stories that make the Florida panther's plight so unique. First of all, it's a subspecies of the puma, or mountain lion family, and it's one of the most endangered large mammals in the world. So I thought we could start with the big picture by having you tell us why the Florida panther is endangered and some of the challenges that affect its survival.
At one time, panthers, or you can call them cougars or pumas, were in almost every state in this country. Due to persecution in the form of actually going out and hunting them as an unwanted predator, and also the loss of their habitat and their food when the eastern portion of the United States was founded and developed. This animal, east of the Mississippi, only survived in the swamps of South Florida.
And is that part of what makes it a subspecies, because it's grown in isolation from the rest of the family?
When work was first done to determine what different subspecies of pumas were in this country, it was thought that there were quite a few more, 23 or 24, I believe. But since the genetics has improved, more recently a study was published that said that throughout the range of the puma, which goes from North America down through South America, that there really are only six distinct subspecies. And the pumas in the United States all are one subspecies.
Okay.
What happened is that this animal became isolated because of development. So there really wasn't a chance for some of the closest animals, like in Texas, to interact again with the panthers down here in South Florida.
And eight female cougars were brought in from Texas to give the species a genetic boost, right? Didn't that happen in the 90s?
Those first panthers that we handled had some unique characteristics. There was a lot of them had a cowlick, or the whorl of hair, on their back. A lot of them had what we call a kinked tail, which actually was at the end vertebrae of their tail were fused. So we saw these characteristics that we thought identified it as a separate subspecies. What it actually was that there were so few animals down here, and probably only one or two males that were the dominant ones that actually were doing the breeding, and they passed these characteristics then on to their offspring.
Okay.
So those characteristics really aren't a problem. If you have a whorl of hair that's different, that doesn't matter. What was found, though, is that these animals also lacked vigor. They were doing poorly in reproduction. The females were having a hard time having and raising any young. And even more importantly, when an animal was killed and they did a necropsy, they found that they had actual holes in their hearts, atrial septal defects.
Wow.
And then, more significantly even, as we did work and handled more animals, we found that most of the males had only one descended testicle, and then there were a few males that we found that were adults but had no testicles. So we were realizing that that extinction vortex was really going full bore, and that
right.
these animals
not
would not
well.
Make it. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, we talked about, well, do we need to put aside more habitat for them? Do we need to protect them on roads? But it was realized, and certainly after, you know, a lot of discussion with genetic experts, a lot of debate among the agencies, but it was realized that even if we gave them more food and more land, that they were so inbred that they weren't going to make it. And that's okay. Why in 1995, there were 8 females from Texas that were brought and released into the South Florida population.
And did they help revive the numbers, and some of the genetic mutations diminished as a result of that?
That is true. I mean, we aren't seeing the colic and the kink as much. When we're doing necropsies, we aren't seeing the holes in the heart. But more significantly, the population, which was estimated in the 80s to be less than 30, and even some people who are experts think that there were probably hardly 20 animals left, that population has increased to more than 100 animals now. And the increase was dramatic since 1995 when those females got here and started reproducing.
Fantastic. And that doesn't mean you're out of the woods yet, so to speak. I know that development and transportation-related deaths continue to affect their numbers, and I'm surprised to read just how high those numbers are. Roads really are affecting their well-being. Can you talk a little bit about that? Doesn't US 41 cut through Big Cypress? Is that a road that jeopardizes their well-being? Are cats being hit on that road?
We have some major roads down here that there where there's a concentration of mortality. One of those was Alligator Alley, and that was going to be upgraded to the interstate system. So because the panther was in such a critical situation, it was decided that when that road was upgraded, that it would be completely fenced and there would be underpasses for wildlife built. So as a result, there are 40 miles of continuous fencing and 35 wildlife underpasses along that stretch of road. So we've had really almost no mortality there in that area. We have another road, State Road 29, which also is a north-south road down here, and that has Big Cypress National Preserve on one side, and on the other side it's the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge and Fakahatchee Strand State Preserve. So most of it on both sides is public land. We continue to have panther mortality there. And 6 underpasses have been put in at key sites where we know that panthers cross or panthers have been killed. However, those 6 underpasses really aren't sufficient, and there isn't continuous fencing along that road. So the result is that we're still having panthers being killed between those sections and between those underpasses.
I see.
As far as Highway 41, it's another east-west road that cuts through Big Cypress. We really have had less mortality. It's a less-traveled road. But we do have one place where we've had even 6 females killed at the spot. It's an area where the vegetation makes a natural corridor for the panthers to cross, and they seem to be, you know, selecting and finding that over time. We had a proposal in to put an underpass there, but there was some opposition to it. So this is an area where it's being proposed to try the RAD system, the roadside animal detection system. And that's where if an animal breaks a beam of light, then the motorist is going to be notified through a sign and hopefully will slow down.
Yeah, I've been reading a little bit about those sensors, and I know they're experimental, but it does seem like they can potentially make a difference. Well, let's jump to you and your work for a moment, Deborah. I'm curious to know what some of your day-to-day duties might be, both in the field and in the office, that you and your team do to support the panther population.
Big Cypress is a multiple-use area, and it's overseen by the National Park Service, but it's one of the few preserves in the national park system. The multiple uses include the continuation of hunting, because the hunters were really instrumental in the establishment of Big Cypress. They were very supportive of it. And it also allows for the continuation of off-road vehicles. We are 729,000 acres, and we're almost roadless. So we have these different uses. So as I said, one of the uses was hunting. When we had that low population of panthers in the 1980s, we really didn't know why. But one hypothesis for Big Cypress was, well, maybe there isn't enough food because we have hunting there. So that's how I started doing the work down here, was to survey Big Cypress, see how many panthers there were. And part of that is also to continue to monitor the prey base. So our, you know, day-to-day duties over time have evolved into just doing survey work, looking for tracks, into actually doing radio telemetry, putting radio collars on these panthers. And I've been running my own capture team for the past 6 years and doing the work out here.
What can you learn from tracking a collared cat?
We're learning some of the basics, such as their home range sizes. We're learning a home range overlap between the males and the females. We're learning what types of habitats can support panthers. And there's a lot of habitat diversity in Big Cypress. Some of our areas are almost all cypress prairie and cypress strands. Some of our areas are more pinelands. Some are open prairies that have more marshes. So what we're learning through our monitoring of the panther is that if we have some areas where we have a predominance of cypress or other habitats that really aren't that conducive for deer, the panthers have larger home ranges. And through this, we're going to be finding out just how many panthers Big Cypress can support long term. We're also learning how the increase in the population is affecting panther survival.
Is there enough food to go around?
Well, the population is increasing. They're reproducing, and the young animals, especially the males, are pushing out and looking for their own habitats that might be vacant, where there's enough food and other females. Unfortunately, many of these young dispersing males are getting killed on the roads. But what we're also beginning to see some indications of is that the females may be getting impacted from habitat saturation or overcrowding in the panther population. And what I mean by that is if you don't have any place to go, then you're going to probably run into the panthers that are within the existing habitat more often. What we're seeing is that there are males now that are killing females, and we don't know if there are conflicts with if the female has she made a deer kill and the male is coming there, or if there's conflicts because the female has young ones. But we're seeing an increase in these females being killed. And in fact, we have documented 15 radio collared females that have been killed. We certainly don't know, you know, what's going on with the uncollared cats. So this is a problem, and it may be just a natural population regulatory system.
I read about one of those females. I think she was collared FP172. She was killed by a male panther. And you think she was killed while defending a deer kill, right?
Yes, that happened just recently.
And the heartbreak of that story is that she had kittens who were orphaned.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? I understand there was quite a search and rescue for those kittens.
Well, that is in the area that the state agency, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation, does the panther work. What alerted them to a problem was that the female was not at the den and her collar was in mortality. We have our collar set up that if they don't move at all for 2 hours, they start beeping faster. So they detected that and they went into where she was. They found that she was dead and they also found that there was a deer kill near there. So she was evidently made a deer kill and was feeding on it, and a male panther came in and, why I don't know, but for some reason killed her. But it's my understanding that they did search for about 3 days for those kittens. Unfortunately, they were at an age where they could fairly easily crawl away from movement. So the team was unsuccessful in finding those kittens. And yes, definitely they would die, because I think about the youngest we've ever documented, an abandoned or orphaned, I should say, kitten surviving has been 10 months, and I think that's pretty rough. We know that they can survive at 12 months, but definitely with they're only 2 months old, they're not going to survive.
Right.
They can't get food on their own.
Have you found orphaned cubs yourself?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we went in after we had handled kittens at one den, just to go back and see if we could see any sign, and we found one of the four kittens still at the den. The mother had moved the other ones. For some reason, she abandoned this one, and there was a little sore on the kitten's head, and it was in poor condition. So we consulted with the veterinarians and decided to pull her out of the wild. And she is now at Lowry Park Zoo. They named her Lucy after the Colusa Indians that once were in this area of Florida.
I remember reading about her, and this is interesting. The other kittens were microchipped, weren't they?
Yes, and we really have learned how valuable these transponders are that we put in the kittens when they're about 2 weeks old. Because, again, when we handle an animal as an adult, we really don't know who it is, but we run that scanner over their back and we get a number readout, and then we're able to check and realize that animal did survive.
That must be interesting to watch these kittens grow and to track their progress. It seems it gives you an opportunity to pay attention to the family, not just the individual.
We had another situation in our capture season this year in which we handled a male that, you know, looked, we knew he was an older male, but we didn't know who he was. We ran that scanner over his back and got a readout, and we found that he was one of the kittens of one of those 8 Texas cougars that were brought down here in 1995.
Oh, how about it?
And so he's 9 years old, and so he sort of eluded us for 9 years, but he's been surviving and obviously passing on his genes to other cats down here. So that was
good
a real thrill.
So when you monitor them, are you actually walking through terrain? Are you in a little plane going over an area? Tell us a little bit about the practicality of tracking a cat.
Our protocol, both agencies have the same protocol, and it's to locate these animals 3 times a week. And we work separately because the animals are in different areas. So one of my staff gets up in a small fixed wing here in Big Cypress and locates the animals from the collared panthers from the air.
When you are working with the kittens, when you're microchipping them, you're also giving them exams, aren't you, and checking to make sure they're healthy? And what happens in that process?
What we do when a female is settled into the same spot for, let's say, four flights, for a good week, then it gives us an indication that she may be denning. Sometimes we also know that she's been with a radio-collared male 3 months prior, which is the gestation period, so we sort of are keeping an eye on her. When we feel that a female is denning, we will go in and set up what we call a den box, where we have a phone system that's hooked up to a battery, and also our receiver, our telemetry receiver. And this is something that Daryl Land from the state agency developed years ago. What it allows us to do is call from any phone to that cell phone's number, and when that picks up, there's an antenna that's aiming at the den. If the female's at the den, we will hear her radio collar beeping, and if she's not, then we'll just get static or white noise. That allows us to monitor her behaviors when she's coming and going from the den. So we're able to monitor remotely to determine when she's going to be leaving the area. And we handle the kittens between 2 and 3 weeks of age. So we're sort of on standby during that week. When we can tell that she's leaving the den and not there, then we will go in and find the kittens and mark them. And besides the transponder, we determine what gender they are. We weigh them. We may take some photos of their tooth eruption, and we will take a small skin plug from their ear for genetics work and give them a little bit of dewormer, and essentially that's it. We try to make the operation really quick so that we don't leave a lot of our scent in the area and so we don't handle the kittens too long.
Right. Those sound like minimal interventions, but necessary mm-hmm. ones. Well, can you conclude, maybe by speaking on a personal note, to say why saving the American lion is important to you?
I think that the people in South Florida are very lucky to have right at their backyard a very large piece of intact habitat in which animals all the way from the panther all the way down can really function normally without, you know, too much worry about being killed on roads or that. To me, it's a healthy ecosystem down here. There aren't really other places yet in the eastern United States where we have that top predator and therefore that healthy system beneath it. As you know, there's problems with too many hogs in some areas. There's problems with too many deer in some areas. So I think it's really impressive to me that not just the people in South Florida, but the rest of the American public have been supportive of saving this animal and thus protecting that whole healthy, balanced system.
And it seems that Florida folks really do love their panther. From what I've read, there are some strong education and outreach programs in place. And what about sharing information with some of your colleagues? It must be helpful to talk with other puma biologists, maybe even in other states, to compare notes. What are some of those interactions like?
Well, we certainly are in almost daily contact with the state agency who's doing the other monitoring. We all are involved with the recovery plan. We have developed a panther response plan. If there's any incidents with panthers that we all need to discuss. And we also, if some of these panthers that we collar move off into their study area, then we share monitoring duty. So we're always in contact with the state here. we need to be thinking about the next steps for the panther, and certainly the agencies are doing that. Ever since the first recovery plan was written, a goal of recovering this animal is to establish at least two other populations in the historic range. This is important because we only have panthers down here in one area in South Florida. Several years ago, we had an outbreak of feline leukemia in which some of them died. Thankfully, that did stop. It didn't spread to the rest of the population. But the agencies know that we need to have this animal established elsewhere. And so we're working to see if maybe other places in Florida or in other southeastern states, we might have enough habitat and also agency and public willingness to have this predator reestablished there.
And where could it go if some of these land issues were successfully addressed? Can it ever get into South Carolina again, Georgia, Louisiana? What's possible?
Well, there's been some studies already just looking at habitat and looking at how many roads there are, how much connected habitat there is. And I know that they've identified places in North Florida and Georgia. They've also identified some places in Arkansas and Louisiana. But again, it's going to take a willingness on the part of the people who live there and the agencies to actually reintroduce panthers. Now, panthers are doing some of this on their own. We have dispersing males that have left South Florida and have been documented in North Florida. In fact, last year there was a panther that was killed in Georgia, and when they did the genetic workup, they found that indeed it was a panther that was born down here in South Florida. So they're trying to find, as I said earlier, they're trying to find their own land and females and enough food. So these males are really, really ranging far. However, we have not yet documented any females leaving South Florida and going into either Central or North Florida. If that happens on its own, that would be wonderful, but then the question is going to be, would she be successful in raising young, and would they be able to survive, or are there too many roads, too many vehicles, that they wouldn't be able to start increasing their numbers? We don't know the answer to that yet.
And would you ever need to reintroduce more cougars to the Florida population, or what are some of the telltale signs you all might see as a red alert, an alarm that might encourage you all to think about those strategies again?
Well, every time we handle a new animal, we're taking the genetic samples, so we're still looking at how the genetics is evolving here. When we have a dead panther, again, they're doing the necropsy and seeing if some of those problems, like the holes in the heart, are beginning to show up more often. So far, that hasn't happened, but we'll continue to monitor to see if we're going to have any signs of inbreeding that would alert us to maybe bringing in some new material again.
And have you had any unusual personal encounters with a panther in the field?
Well, first of all, when we go out and monitor the dens, we are very careful to make sure that the female is a long ways away and out hunting. So we don't go to a den when the female is there. And in all the years that I've been down here and been in the field either doing panther work or other work, there's only one situation where I actually just randomly saw a panther cross a road. But I do hear occasionally stories from the hunters, and I do believe them, that, you know, they're out there in the field and they see a deer and they're crawling through the grasses trying to get closer to the deer so that they can get a good shot. Maybe they're an archer or something. And they all of a sudden are looking at a panther who is also crawling through the grass to try to get closer to the to the deer, and they, you know, scare each other and both go running in the opposite directions. And some of these are authentic stories. I think it's happened a few times with some of our hunters. And then they'll also tell us about sitting in a tree stand, and, you know, next to a trail, and in the early morning seeing perhaps a female and a couple kittens behind her walking down the trail. And they always call and say what a wonderful experience that was.
Well, thank you. Thank you for speaking with us today, Deborah. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This has been a Mountain Lion Foundation On Air broadcast. On Air is a copyrighted production of the Mountain Lion Foundation. Permission to rebroadcast is granted for non-commercial use. For more information, visit mountainlion.org.